NBC executives are not having an easy time since their decision to move Jay Leno back to late night. Today, The Tonight Show host Conan O'Brien released a statement saying that he did not want to move his show back after midnight to make room for Leno. He wrote this about The Tonight Show: "I cannot participate in what I honestly believe is its destruction." O'Brien did not say that he was quitting the show or the network.
NBC has not one programming problem, but many: how to rearrange its late night and how to fill 5 empty hours of primetime. Commentator Andrew Wallenstein says there's one show that's going to benefit from the whole mess. You can watch it tonight, just not on NBC.
Try as NBC might to restore order to its schedule, there's damage to one show that can't be undone: Southland.
Put your hands in the car, palms down.
It's a gritty show that followed the LAPD on the mean streets of Los Angeles.
Get out of the car.
Well, I'd have to get out of the car.
Get out of the car now, numbers.
You know who my father is?
What? Your mother didn't tell you?
When it started last April, Southland seemed as if it was going to follow in the tradition of great NBC cop dramas, like Dragnet and Hill Street Blues.
I'm being punked, right?
Search the car.
Hey, you're making a big mistake. You can't search my car without just cause.
You're watching way too much TV, dude.
But in October, NBC shocked the TV world by canceling it just 2 weeks before its second season was to begin. Southland was created by one of TV's top producers, John Wells, who seemed to be bringing NBC the kind of praise he had delivered before, with ER and The West Wing. But to understand the show's ouster, one must blame Leno. Shifting Leno to 10 p.m. 5 nights a week meant shows like Southland were pushed to 9 p.m., which isn't traditionally the place broadcast schedules its edgiest fare. Thank heavens for cable network TNT, which snapped up rights to the show. They're replaying its first season beginning tonight. In March, the never-seen second season will unspool. Now, basic cable may seem like a demotion, but networks like TNT have an increasingly strong track record nurturing hit dramas like The Closer and Saving Grace. Plus, cable affords shows the creative license they need to be as gritty as they want, so listen for a few less bleeps on Southland this time around. So don't go feeling sorry for Southland. If you want to send condolences to the casualties of NBC's implosion, try its local affiliates, or maybe even Conan O'Brien. But Southland, it's just where it should be.
That commentary from Andrew Wallenstein of The Hollywood Reporter.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
England, along with much of mainland Europe, is shivering through a cold snap. And one place that's been great news is in southeastern England near Cambridge. The fens, the marshy wetlands there, were frozen solid enough to allow the return of a historic speed skating race for the first time in 13 years. And skaters hope the cold will last through this weekend so they can hold the British and Fenland Championships. Malcolm Robinson is secretary of the Fenland Skating Center. And Mr. Robinson, first tell us about what appears to be the glorious and long history of speed skating on the fens. How far back does it go?
Way back to the 1700s and even sooner. Originally, it sort of started out with a means of transport, you know, travelling across the ice when it was frozen. And it's gradually progressed to what it is today, where we actually get out and race whenever possible.
Now, you grew up, I understand, on a farm near where you are right now, and you would remember, I guess, skating on the Fenlands as a regular, normal thing during a winter.
Well, whether the memory plays tricks with you or not, I'm not sure, but I always remember as a child that we seemed to skate every year, whether it be little or much, somewhere on a piece of frozen water.
That's the memory, anyway.
Yeah.
But not so much now.
In the last 10, 15 years, it's been very few and far between. Really, our glory years, as far as sort of modern times go, was in the mid-80s when we had 3 years back-to-back.
Well, what was the scene this past weekend when you had the preliminary races there? Who came out?
Mostly, they was locals, anything sort of from 40, 50 miles away. But it was amazing the turnout we had from sort of general public turning up on hockey skates or figure skates, even old fen skates that they'd found in the cupboard and that sort of thing.
Fen skates?
what we call fen runners, the wooden style ones that sort of fit to the bottom of the boot rather than a custom fit boot with the blade already attached.
Now, who would still have skates like that or blades like that?
As I said, it used to be a real tradition for this area, so more or less every family that was involved would have a selection of skates sort of hanging up somewhere that would be dusted off should there be the chance to use them.
How does the race itself work? What's the course?
What we skate on is an oval track similar to a running track, and because of like the history of it, we're still on yard measurements rather than metres. So it's 440 yards we skate, which sort of equate to quarter miles, half miles, or miles. Well, we go up to the longest race we've got is a 3-mile race.
Did you race yourself last weekend?
I did.
How'd you do?
I came second.
Wow, not bad.
I was pleased.
I bet that's just a great feeling when you were able to skate on the fens this past weekend to think about the long history, hundreds of years of skating there, and to know that you were part of that tradition yet again.
It's something that seems to be in the blood. Because all of us don't skate on the rinks or anything. We only skate on the fens when it's frozen. So to actually just get stuff off the ground this weekend was fantastic.
Well, everybody's looking ahead now to this coming weekend, and the hope, as we said, is that you can have the championship race. When was the last time it was cold enough and you had enough ice to hold a championship?
Back in 1997.
Well, are you and your fellow skaters kind of sending great thoughts up to the weather gods to try to keep that cold weather coming?
We sort of go round and we listen to all the old folks and they say, well, if this is happening, that's going to be cold. And we listen to all that rather than the weather forecast is where they say it's coming milder.
Now, what are the old folks telling you to look for?
Berries on the hedge and what the birds are doing and that sort of thing. What the hedges, how they look, whether they're starting to bud up or whether they're still sort of shut right down.
And when you look at those signs, what are you seeing?
It's still winter, and I think we're in with a chance.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for you.
Great stuff.
Mr. Robinson, thanks so much.
That's all right. No problem.
That's Malcolm Robinson, Secretary of the Fenland Skating Center, speaking with us from the village of Sutton in Cambridgeshire, England.
This is NPR News.
England, along with much of mainland Europe, is shivering through a cold snap. And one place that's been great news is in southeastern England near Cambridge. The fens, the marshy wetlands there, were frozen solid enough to allow the return of a historic speed skating race for the first time in 13 years. And skaters hope the cold will last through this weekend so they can hold the British and Fenland Championships. Malcolm Robinson is Secretary of the Fenland Skating Center. And Mr. Robinson, first tell us about what appears to be the glorious and long history of speed skating on the fens. How far back does it go?
Way back to the 1700s and even sooner. Originally, it sort of started out as a means of transport, you know, travelling across the ice when it was frozen, and it's gradually progressed to what it is today, where we actually get out and race whenever possible.
Now, you grew up, I understand, on a farm near where you are right now, and you would remember, I guess, skating on the Fenlands as a regular, normal thing during a winter.
Well, whether the memory plays tricks with you or not, I'm not sure, but I always remember as a child that we seemed to skate every year, whether it be little or much, somewhere on a piece of frozen water.
That's the memory, anyway.
Yeah.
But not so much now.
In the last 10, 15 years, it's been very few and far between. Really, our glory years, as far as sort of modern times go, was in the mid-80s when we had 3 years back-to-back.
Well, what was the scene this past weekend when you had the preliminary races there? Who came out?
Mostly, they was locals, anything sort of from 40, 50 miles away. But it was amazing the turnout we had from sort of general public turning up on hockey skates or figure skates, even old fen skates that they'd found in the cupboard and that sort of thing.
Fen skates?
What we call fen runners, the wooden style ones that sort of fit to the bottom of the boot rather than a custom fit boot with the blade already attached.
Now, who would still have skates like that or blades like that?
As I said, it used to be a real tradition for this area, so more or less every family that was involved would have a selection of skates sort of hanging up somewhere that would be dusted off should there be the chance to use them.
How does the race itself work? What's the course?
What we skate on is an oval track similar to a running track, and because of like the history of it, we're still on yard measurements rather than metres. So it's 440 yards we skate, which sort of equate to quarter miles, half miles or miles. Well, we go up to the longest race we've got is a 3-mile race.
Did you race yourself last weekend?
I did.
How'd you do?
I came second.
Wow, not bad.
I was pleased.
I bet that's just a great feeling when you were able to skate on the Fens this past weekend to think about the long history, hundreds of years of skating there, and to know that you were part of that tradition yet again.
It's something that seems to be in the blood, because all of us don't skate on the rinks or anything. We only skate on the Fens when it's frozen. So to actually just get stuff off the ground this weekend was fantastic.
Well, everybody's looking ahead now to this coming weekend, and the hope, as we said, is that you can have the championship race. When was the last time it was cold enough and you had enough ice to hold a championship?
Back in 1997.
Well, are you and your fellow skaters kind of sending great thoughts up to the weather gods to try to keep that cold weather coming?
We sort of go round and we listen to all the old folks, and they say, well, if this is happening, that's going to be cold, and we listen to all that rather than the weather forecast, is where they say it's coming milder.
Now, what are the old folks telling you to look for?
Berries on the hedge and what the birds are doing and that sort of thing. What the hedges, how they look, whether they're starting to bud up or whether they're still sort of shut right down.
And when you look at those signs, what are you seeing?
It's still winter, and I think we're in with a chance.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed for you.
Great stuff.
Mr. Robinson, thanks so much.
That's all right. No problem.
That's Malcolm Robinson, Secretary of the Fenland Skating Center, speaking with us from the village of Sutton in Cambridgeshire, England.
This is NPR News. What will future generations learn about us from our art? Well, philosopher and commentator Alain de Botton says that they certainly will not learn about our work.
If a Martian came to Earth and tried to understand what human beings do just from reading most literature published today, he would come away with the extraordinary impression that we basically spend our time falling in love, squabbling with our families, and occasionally murdering one another. But of course, what we really do is go to work. And yet this work is unseen. It's literally invisible. And it's so in part because it's rarely represented in art. If it does appear in consciousness, it does so via the business pages of newspapers. It does so as an economic phenomenon rather than a broader human phenomenon. 2 centuries ago, our forebearers would have known the precise history and source of almost every one of the limited number of things they ate and owned. They would have been familiar with the pig, the carpenter, the weaver, the loom, and the dairymaid. The range of items available for purchase may have grown exponentially since then, but our understanding of their genesis has grown ever more obscure. We are now as imaginatively disconnected from the production and distribution of our goods as we are practically in reach of them, a process of alienation which has stripped us of opportunities for wonder, gratitude, and guilt. How ignorant most of us are, surrounded by machines and processes of which we have only the loosest grasps. We who know nothing about gantry cranes and iron ore bulk carriers, who register the economy only as a set of numbers, who think, even now, that it's only about money, who've avoided close study of switch gears and wheat storage and spare ourselves closer acquaintance with the manufacturing protocols for tensile steel cable. At a time when recession is reminding us how badly we need work, it should be artists who teach us to discern the virtues of the furniture of contemporary technology. One can hope for a day when photographs of electricity conductors might hang over dining tables, and when someone might write a libretto for an opera set in the sales office of a packaging firm. We need art that could function for our times a little like those 18th century cityscapes, which show us people at work from the quayside to the temple, the parliament to the counting house, panoramas like those of Canaletto, in which, within a single giant frame, one can witness dockers unloading crates, merchants bargaining in the main square, bakers before their ovens, women sewing at their windows, and councils of ministers assembled in a palace. Inclusive scenes which serve to remind us of the place which work accords each one of us within the human hive. We need an art that can proclaim the intelligence, peculiarity, beauty and horror of the modern workplace, and not least its extraordinary claim to be able to provide us, along with love, despite the current economic mayhem, with the principal source of life's meaning.
Philosopher Alain de Botton, he's the author of The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.